Uncle Don here with the 283rd edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Rebroadcasts may be picked up on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. Here we go with a federal election campaign, the coming of which was the worst-kept secret in Canada. Harper pulled the plug, visiting the Governor General in a pro forma bow to the royal prerogative to dissolve Parliament. Now we have over a month to endure the onslaught of propaganda, promises, and the whole bag of tricks that we've come to expect from candidates and their parties. Harper has an edge as he spread promises of goodies where they will buy the votes of those afraid that pledges will not be honored if Tories don't win their ridings. Thus were made promises in Ontario to Generous Motors and Ford to subsidize their operations. Funny thing, but I seem to remember a younger Harper ridiculing liberal subsidies to corporations when he last ran for office. But no matter. This is a man of no obvious principles and overarching ambition, and ambition for what many Canadians fear. Conservatives tell us we need a strong leader and that Dion is too much of an egghead who vacillates when hard decisions must be made. I have no doubt that Harper, as Prime Minister in a majority government, would be a strong leader. But is that what we want? Can you name three past strong leaders? How about Augusto Pinochet, Adolf Hitler, and Joseph Stalin? I don't much care for strength of leadership. I just want the leader to head our nation in the right direction, or should I say the correct direction. Nothing better illustrates Stephen Harper's disdain for the rule of law than his circumventing his own fixed-date election law. He rammed this law through Parliament as one of his first acts as Prime Minister 2 years ago. Now he ignores the intent, if not the letter, of that very law to demand an early election. Why would he do this? He claims that Parliament has been hamstrung by opposition fiddling. Yet it was the Conservatives who circulated a secret guidebook of some 200 pages to its committee chairman with instructions as to how to shut down hearings that were not going their way. A number of Conservative investigations and scandals are ripening, and dissolving Parliament closes down these investigations. In addition, this man who represents himself as an economist and the bane of budget deficits has turned a hefty surplus into negative territory just as we are dipping into a recession. If Harper keeps his seat as Prime Minister, will he again defy his own fixed election date law when the next one is due in 2009? Why not? I'll let up on the federal Conservatives for a minute to look at the record of our provincial Liberals. These clowns were elected based on religious credentials, professed concern for NDP waste in building three fast ferries, family values, and general right-wing propaganda. What did we get? A squandering of resources on the Olympics that defies imagination. And these prudent stewards of the public purse have blown more than on the Vancouver Convention and Trade Center overruns than the total cost of these three NDP ferries. MLAs gave themselves hefty pay increases and recently showed their appreciation for senior bureaucrats by raising their salaries by as much as 40%. Now that is generosity. What a pity they did not extend that generosity to those struggling with the minimum wage of $8, a wage level that's even denied to many persons entering the labor force. In reply to pressure to bring in a $10 minimum wage, the Liberals replied that very few workers earn that little already, so that an increase would have no effect. Oh yeah? Look around Prince George at the McDonald's fast food joint sporting huge signs reading, "Now hiring, $8.50 part-time, $9.50 full-time." Supposedly, those bureaucrats need huge increases in pay to keep them from running off to better wages elsewhere. But don't our license plates read, "Best place on earth"? Shouldn't people of talent be flocking to British Columbia even if wages were lower, just for the lifestyle? In their wisdom, the Liberal government closed all provincial prison camps to shrink employment in BC corrections. Very clever. Rather than keep low-risk prisoners in settings where the per capita daily cost is in the neighborhood of $30 a day, they were shifted to secure jails where the cost is over $100. Now our secure prisons are so crowded that the Kamloops Regional Correctional Center is refusing new admissions, forcing police to keep them in city jails at added expense. Very clever, these bean-counting Liberals. Just keep this in mind when our next provincial election rolls around. In my time, working on several levels of various governments, I've seen many examples of bureaucrats and politicians evading rules, regulations, and laws. When I was shipped to the Panama Canal Zone as an Army Ordnance Supply Specialist, I found there were no official openings for my specialty. I was reduced to going from unit to unit looking for work. Failure to land a spot would have seen me sent to the infantry, where I could look forward to 3 years of mud and snakes, lending an element of desperation to my search. I found a supply depot willing to carry me off the books as a supernumerary, supplementing the work of civilians whose numbers was strictly limited. For over 2 years, I was hidden in this outfit. Here in Prince George, I was hired as a clerk for the local unemployment insurance commission at a time when there was a federal hiring freeze. In my interview, I asked how I could be hired during a freeze, and the reply was, "Well, we're a long way from Ottawa." For a year, I worked in the position of business manager at the local jail. Each year, we were given a budget by the provincial government, which we were supposed to stay within. Each year, like clockwork, the jail overspent many categories. How did they do this? Invariably, they received forgiveness behind the excuse of overcrowding. To some extent, this was legitimate, but it also served as a smokescreen behind which a lot of wasteful spending was hidden. Harper's disregard for rules, regulations, and laws is not unique. It seems to be a hallmark of the bureaucracy that these are mere impediments to be circumvented in pursuits of one's own goals. It's a political cliche that a single bridge can win several elections. The classic way it works is that a candidate pledges to fund a much-needed bridge if elected. After winning on that pledge, he finds barriers, usually fiscal, to the construction. Plans are stalled. Lo and behold, during the next campaign, he again promises that bridge, wins the seat, and the cycle goes on. Maybe the good citizens will get their promised structure and maybe not, but the politician making the promises wins election again and again. Cast your mind back a couple of years to the election that gave us our dear Stephen Harper his position as Prime Minister. A solemn pledge helping to win that seat was that he would build 3 mighty icebreakers to patrol the Arctic Ocean, protecting our northern sovereignty year-round. Once in office, those all-weather icebreakers morphed into little patrol boats, ones incapable of operating in winter ice and seas. Now the contracts for patrol boats have been suspended, supposedly because bids on their building were not satisfactory. Add to that $3 billion in ship upgrades not forthcoming from a government more intent on reducing corporate taxes than protecting our sovereignty. So where did Harper go last week? To the Arctic, making a grand show of huff and puff and bluff over how we must protect our Northwest Passage as an inland waterway. Of course, we cannot actually do more than fly over an intruding ship and drop pamphlets, but rest assured that those flimsy patrol boats will be in the water and on duty, in the summer at least, by 2013. The 2008 budget included an icebreaker already dubbed the HMCS Diefenbaker, but plans have yet to be drawn, and the earliest it could hit the water, if it should ever be built and paid for, is 2017. Big deal. Until then, it will be Inuit in kayaks waving maple leaf flags at foreign ships. Now that Harper called the election, perhaps he will pull the old bridge trick by promising us more ice-breaking ships, yet again. Might it be the conservative plan to allow our Navy to rust away deliberately so that a future government will be forced to acknowledge that the Northwest Passage is a de facto international waterway to be patrolled by our faithful friends, the Americans? This string of procrastination certainly looks like a politically charged decision to back off our sovereignty claims, leaving the big boys, Russia and the U.S., to pursue their Cold War in the Arctic Ocean and, incidentally, reap the resource spoils beneath the seas that were once claimed by Canada. Those of you who missed Doug Strachan's Common Sense show for 29 August on CFUR will have to excuse my following replies. Doug followed the right-wing script we have become used to in the rhetoric that flows from Stephen Harper and his tightly controlled followers. Harper is using the Trudeau legacy as a brush to tar Stéphane Dion as an extreme lefty. Doug belittled Trudeau and his national energy program, and that saddened me. As a fervent Canadian nationalist, I was a strong supporter of the NEP, and I'm proud of that. The fact that the NEP was so strenuously attacked by big oil and their bought-and-paid-for government in Alberta is a testimony to its value to Canada's future. Unfortunately, the power of the media, galvanized by cash and a script from conservative think tanks, was able to turn Canadians against this program that was patently in their own long-term interest. The National Energy Program was introduced in 1980 by Trudeau's Liberals after a huge run-up in prices charged by foreign oil companies. Although portrayed by Conservatives as a battle for revenue between Alberta and Ottawa, the NEP had three objectives. It sought to achieve energy security, greater Canadian ownership of our own energy resources, and a redistribution of wealth from oil companies in Alberta toward the federal government and consumers. History of the last quarter century has proven Trudeau right, but a constant flood of propaganda has masked these objectives, painting the NEP as a power grab by Ottawa. Well, the burying has been efficient and the bodies are buried deeply. If Trudeau's program had not been scuttled by Conservatives and their corporate masters, where might Canada be now? As we stand, we have no energy security. Petro-Canada was given away, its gasoline stations standing with their red maple leaves mocking our attempt to have public participation in our resource uses. Restrictions on exports of oil and gas to those surplus to Canada's future needs have been abolished. Mulroney's treasonous trade deals with the United States oblige us to fill American gas tanks, even if we lack energy for our own economy. Alberta has proven to be a poor steward of its own resources. Their firmly entrenched Conservatives encourage the unrestrained exploitation of their tar sands with little regard for environmental devastation or economic distortions making a mess of the rest of the country. Canadian ownership is not encouraged by today's enemies of the old National Energy Program. Let Shell, Exxon, and their sisters rip up the land, suck up the rivers, and fill lakes of toxic sludge while paying minuscule royalties. Let the pipelines be built to carry our oil to American refineries, which will, for a handsome markup, return their products to Canadians to be sold through gas stations which just happen to post identical prices. No, Doug, the National Energy Program is not a bit of our history to be belittled. Its demise at the hands of the greedy and ignorant is a shameful chapter in Canada's recent past. On that same show, Doug Strachan belittled Crown corporations. He made two assertions that he can't get away with. He stated that public corporations being sold off helter-skelter by Conservative governments are all money losers. He further stated that governments would be crazy to sell off entities that prove to be cash cows whose profits offset taxes for revenue. Doug mentioned a close relative who gave him information of British Columbia Railway and how the provincial government had to write off huge amounts of its debts before giving it to Canadian National. Leaving aside the federal Conservatives' gift of CN to the private sector, let's look at BC Rail. I have my own contacts with that former Crown Corporation in the person of a past member of its board of directors. According to her, BCR sent Victoria a healthy check each year in lieu of taxes, a check drawn from its profit. Not content with this income, Campbell's misnamed Liberals unilaterally demanded a much higher royalty, one which put the Crown Corporation in the red in spite of profits. Campbell was then able to engineer the gift of BCR to CN as a proven loser for the government. When the Social Credit government went headlong into developing Tumbler Ridge's coal deposits, they constructed a railway to the site, shifting and hiding the cost for a line that proved unwise to the BC Rail Corporation, where they should have been borne by government. When the coal contract with Japan proved to be legally flawed, allowing buyers to opt out in favor of cheaper supplies from Australia, BCR was left holding the bag and paying interest in perpetuity. What would you guess is the most widely distributed publication in British Columbia? My candidate is Luck, a giveaway from your friendly BC Lottery Corporation. Available in every bloody gambling joint, come convenience store, gas station, supermarket, and other places where one can blow one's cash on a long shot with bad odds on payoffs. Luck is a slim periodical on newsprint, replete with photos of happy folk holding checks while bearing vapid smiles. In the trade, these pictures are called grippin' grins. You can't win if you don't play, goes the sales pitch. The other side of that is, of course, you can't lose if you don't play. As for me, I've never been a gambler, even though I've been through Las Vegas several times. Not that I kept clear of casinos. Casinos are great places to people watch, and I did come out better than most, as I found a nickel on the floor of one. Follow-up studies have been done on happy winners of grand lottery prizes, yielding surprising results. When one wins untold millions, there's a syndrome that begins for the average gambler. First, he or she goes to work and tells the boss to get stuffed. Then they go on buying sprees with new houses, cars, cruises, and the whole works. After that splurge, they try to settle down, only to find they have problems. They may discover that they have more friends than they ever realized, all expecting them to pick up the tab or lend money. They find that real friends are difficult to deal with. Those from their former work no longer have anything in common with them. Others are uncomfortable dealing with the new millionaires, and everyone wonders who will pay the check if they go out. All manner of charities, investment advisors, and wannabe parasites plague them until they are afraid to answer the phone or door. Through bad investments, extravagant purchases, and expensive travel, these folks find themselves rapidly losing their wealth. For those unwise enough to blow it all, they discover they burn bridges and work is hard to come by. Meanwhile, the expensive toys and houses cost a lot to maintain, so they're sold off one by one until the poor winner is left in a miserable state physically and mentally. Admittedly, there are those clever enough to avoid the worst of this scenario, but the lottery corporation makes it difficult. A condition of picking up the prize check is submission to the photo and publication of biographical information. Parasites read this luck rag and latch onto winners in short order with their pitches. If you want to build wealth, I suggest that you keep your spending within your income. For those not familiar with the concept, the residue is called savings, which can be left in the care of your local bank or credit union. Savings build and eventually will allow you those luxuries you dream of when throwing money at a long-shot lottery prize. Of course, you can do as I did by adding to savings through a fortuitous choice of relatives who can grant you an inheritance, but this is a feat that cannot be achieved retroactively. Better to save and wait than to try to choose your ancestors. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. When the Sea to Sky Highway was planned, one option for dealing with crumbling cliffs was to bore tunnels through them. This was rejected, so the current road runs directly under those cliffs, leading to inevitable rockfalls such as the one recently closing the highway for days. The initial cost for a 1-kilometer tunnel behind Porto Bluff would have been $200 million. With subsequent inflation, we might expect one to run a cool billion, but only if conventional methods are used. Aye, there's the rub, conventional methods. Time to think outside the box. Where can we find experts on tunnel building overseas? Norway has experts in such construction as the country is laced with tunnels, but their methods are conventional. The greatest concentration of tunnels on the planet is where you might not expect. It's under the border between Gaza and Egypt. If Canada were to open our immigration to those experts on surreptitious boring, we could put their expertise to work, shaving the cost of construction to a fraction of current estimates. Write your member of the legislature, and don't forget to credit Uncle Don. Our local press trumpets the supposed fact that Prince George's crime rate is falling. The Solicitor General's office says that in 2007 there were 986 fewer criminal code offenses reported than in the previous year. Last year saw 1,788 violent crimes, 1,185 break-and-enters, and 1,796 acts of vandalism reported. The key word here is reported. There's no reason to believe that all incidents are reported, as many factors can influence the motivation to report a crime. The following is a rhetorical question. Does the fall in reported crimes indicate an actual reduction of crime or a reduced incentive to tell the police? Many years ago, when I lived downtown, I was a victim of a break-and-enter. I reported it to police, who gave the impression that they were more interested in adding this to their statistics than in investigating it. At that time, I had a plate glass desktop under which I had arrayed a collection of paper money from my travels. The burglar had swept a number of these bills from under the glass, a glass that I had just cleaned thoroughly. I told the police that there were probably fingerprints on the glass, and after repeated requests for 3 days, they sent a man over to dust for prints. Amazingly enough, he claimed to find none. If I had experienced another break-in, would I have reported it, knowing that there was no obvious interest in catching the perpetrator? I think not. Dealing with the police was an inconvenience, netting no benefit to me. Where we live now, we're plagued with unlicensed motorcycles, all-terrain vehicles, and, in season, snowmobiles racing up and down our road. I reported this to the police, and the reply I got from one officer was that they would not play Keystone Cop by pursuing these vehicles in spite of their violating laws against such vehicles on city streets. Will I report future invasions of these dangerous, obnoxious machines? No. We live near a nature reserve, often hit by vandals. We've reported these acts to no avail. Even if the perpetrators are at work when we call, these acts have a low priority for police, who are often quite busy downtown. In the evenings, there's usually one rural officer on patrol between the Nechaco River and Mackenzie. He or she cannot attend every incident, so many, like ours, go unreported. I have no idea whether the incidence of crimes in our area has increased or decreased, but I'm sure that the official statistics are a fantasy when it comes to determining this. Harper's government has a contract with an American company to teach our soldiers in Afghanistan to understand their Taliban adversaries. A contract notice posted by the Canadian government stated that past cultural awareness training received by our soldiers, quote, did not provide the operational relevance required to conduct counterinsurgency warfare. This contract was not put out to bids, though it will cost Canadian taxpayers $848,250 each year, U.S. It went on a sole source basis, meaning that the recipient, Terrorism Research Center of Arlington, Virginia, was considered to be the only outfit capable of presenting this training. 1 year ago, a mere 5 years after we joined the invasion of Afghanistan, our Department of National Defense determined that our troops require special instruction on how the Afghan population thinks. Well, now, isn't that timely? So the DND has finally awakened to the fact and decided that our military has not learned how the population thinks after living and fighting there for half a decade. Only Americans know how the Afghans think. This is demonstrated by the fact that Afghan resistance fighters stymie the most high-tech army ever fielded. They can do it while working with antiquated guns, fabricated bombs, and trotting around in sandals. Shades of Vietnam. This contracted outfit, the Terrorism Research Center, is part of Total Intelligence Solutions, LLC. Total Intelligence Solutions is, in turn, a subsidiary of the Prince Group, a holding company that also owns Blackwater Worldwide, grand supplier of out-of-control mercenaries in Afghanistan and Iraq. If this Terrorism Research Center shows the same sensitivity to Afghan custom and culture as does its sister Blackwater, our troops will be in for quite an indoctrination. It's most revealing here on the eve of a federal election where the current Harper regime's interests lie. As in most cases, it can be ascertained by following the money. On the one hand, the conservatives are cutting millions in aid to the arts while pledging $20 million to opening ceremonies for the 2010 Olympic Games, if they represent Canadian values. And Harper demands a veteran, a surviving one, of the war against Afghanistan, to lead the torch relay. Let's remember who started this hallowed tradition of having runners fan out through territories soon to be overrun. Harper canceled a signed $100,000 contract with the Sierra Club of British Columbia that was to fund initiatives to cut household greenhouse gas emissions. Meanwhile, I learned, thanks to the Gold River Record, that the conservative bunch pledged $1.1 million as a grant to Synex Energy, an outfit on Vancouver Island that will harness a river owned by the people of British Columbia, for power. This is one of Campbell's independent power production projects, filling the needs for electricity formerly handled by our own corporation, BC Hydro. So this privately owned company will harness the falling water potential of a public river, then sell that power to BC Hydro, which will distribute it, selling the electricity to industrial enterprises at less than cost. All this subsidized by the federal purse to make it look like a worthwhile venture. If there was any doubt that the provincial so-called liberals were just a local branch of the so-called federal conservatives, this erases it. Without generous federal and provincial government support, these damned, no pun intended, projects would not be viable, and our crown corporation, BC Hydro, could get on with the job of harnessing falling water to provide us all with cheap, reliable electricity. My wife and I are traitors to our class. We do not work. We are parasitical in that we live on interest and dividends earned by the sweat of the brows of others. We have secure pensions, including Canada Social Insurance and American Social Security. We're old enough that we'll not likely live to see the fruits of damage caused by our generation's greed and disregard for posterity. We should be happily supporting Stephen Harper and his buddy McCain. We should vote conservative and contribute to the party. But we do not. We are cursed with social conscience and concern for the future of our nation and the human race. We recognize that we have obligations to our society and to posterity. We support local charities and good causes. We should not have to contribute to charities. In our estimation, the very existence of private charities indicates that the goal of alleviating inequality has failed. We believe that meaningful jobs should be available to every person willing and able to work. We believe that an individual, by virtue of being human and a citizen, has the right to a minimum standard of food, clothing, and shelter. Some people would choose to reject work and live in a minimalist manner on a dole. So, a country as rich as Canada can afford it. Their money would circulate just like everyone else's and support the economy. They might choose to contribute in non-economic ways, like through the arts. We should exult in the constant reduction of our legal obligation to contribute to governing the country through the erosion of tax obligations. We do not. Taxes are the cost of maintaining civilization, and the wealthy should be tapped the most heavily, as they have the greatest interest in maintaining stability. We dislike Stephen Harper and his self-important bunch of power-hungry servants of corporations and the rich. Even an intelligent member of Parliament like Jay Hill has sold his soul to the establishment. His less qualified, experienced, and principled followers like Dick Harris and UNBC's stuffed shirt alumnus James Moore are embarrassments. No, we will not troop to the polls voting for representatives of the rich, the greedy, the superstitious, the know-nothings, who will sell out our country for short-term gratification. Canada has the potential to be a great nation. It was once on track to be. Now we fall into the status of sycophants of the American regime, fighting their wars and providing the resources to fuel their nation while ignoring the legitimate future needs of our children. Stephen Harper's regime is an embarrassment and should be deposed in favor of an administration that pays more than lip service to greatness. I'm torn between two worlds as defined by John McCain. According to him and his running mate, we are all divided between decent, God-fearing, ignorant, redneck, rural folk and with family values and homosexual-loving, atheistic, socialistic, overeducated, elitist, liberal city slickers. I just don't know where I stand since I'm technically a city slicker with all those vices while being a rural property owner surrounded with goodness and light. Am I a cracker or a snob? Gee. I guess I have to throw in my lot with the city folk, although I enjoy living where I have room to swing a cat. I don't own a snowmobile, trail bike, or an all-terrain vehicle. I don't support those family values that lead the salt of the earth to homeschooling to protect their tender offspring from thoughts, like the planet being over 6,000 years old, and that there are greater fonts of wisdom than the Bible. I have gay friends and have never attended a lynching, even though I matured in the States. I went beyond high school and have been exposed to wisdom beyond that espoused in an evangelical gathering. Who but one of those good old country boys would post a profile of himself on Facebook claiming to be, quote, a fucking redneck? This is the youth who would be the son-in-law of the future American vice president, and that woman embraces him and his values. Here at home, we have Stephen Harper sidestepping citizenship among either the city or country cousins. He's a hermaphrodite claiming the virtues of both. He's a hockey dad who loves to be with his family, though he seldom demonstrates his affinity except during photo opportunities, as when he and his bodyguards take his daughter to school. Touching. It's a wonder he does not cast off his ambitions and spend more time with his precious family. This has been your Uncle Don with the 283rd presentation of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, rebroadcast on CGLY in Nelson Kootenay Lake, and CHLS in Lillooet.